Hello and welcome to episode 66 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
Unfortunately, we've got no Cookie or Retroid this week. However, we are once again joined by Peter Cooper.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
I feel slightly not quite outnumbered, but the Paul ratio has dropped majorly on this podcast today.
Do you feel scared, Paul?
Yes, I need my Paul people.
Need your pool people.
Your peoples.
Yes. Need your peoples pool.
Yeah. Anyway.
Your peoples. Peoples would work.
Anyway, this week we're going to be discussing several things, including gamers puzzled, bemused, and totally left, probably left hanging by superbly done Fallout 4 hoax site. And Batkid swoops in and saves the day with the help of 15,000 strangers. And, big feature for today is the difficulties of literary adaptations.
But first, the news. So, okay, since this originally happened, I want to say it was spotted that it was either ZeniMax or Bethesda has either refiled or filed new trademarks for Fallout 4 in Europe. But last week, circulating over the internet, and I went on the site, a website popped up called, the address is thesurvivor2299.com, which is like a very convincing countdown to an announcement kind of site with a whole load of kind of Fallout-esque references in the CSS script.
They got me.
Did they?
They did.
Because, yeah.
I was so hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, the script was a bit interesting, and they had a lot of stuff in there that was kind of potentially unnecessary, that was trying to link back to stuff on like the official Bethesda website and stuff. But for me, and I didn't read any news stories about the Hoosers information. I went and checked out the Hoosers information myself, and I was just kind of like, this is interesting, because I went on like, was it like Bethsoft or whatever, one of the official blogs, you know, websites for the company, looked at the Hoosers registration details for that, then compared it to the Hoosers registration details for this website that popped up. And the thing that kind of was making me go about this website that popped up was the fact that they'd registered it through GoDaddy, whereas the official websites that are definitely genuine were all registered with corporate domains. And it also looked like with the Survivor one, that which somebody pointed out in one of the articles I read about it, was that the server being used looked like it was in Poland, which also made no sense. Kind of made, obviously, sense for Bethesda to be using stuff that was based stateside. So it was a very... But all the contact information on the Hoosers, like all the emails and the... I think name servers or NS servers or whatever that were being used and all that, that was like the same as previous website listings for domains for Bethesda. So, yeah, it was very, very convincing. But then, like I said, then today it was kind of revealed that, oh, they've you know, registered the Fallout 4 trademark in Europe. So maybe they are up to something.
There's demand.
There's demand. In all honesty, it would probably be Fallout 4, as long as it wasn't as buggy as New Vegas. Okay? It'd be Fallout 4 that would convince me that maybe I would like one of the new generation consoles. Because I loved playing Fallout 3 on my Xbox 360. Absolutely loved it. Not New Vegas, but Fallout 3 I was absolutely fine with.
I really, really adored Fallout 3. It was an absolutely amazing game.
It was.
And when I saw this, I don't know if you recall the ModernWarfare3.com debacle. Do you remember that?
Did somebody register a whole load of...
Somebody registered ModernWarfare3.com.
Yeah.
And nothing happened with it. It was just a dead site. And then one day, a ticking clock began. and it was counting down, and people were just staring at this clock, waiting for something to happen, going, oh my God, there's going to be a teaser trailer. Oh my God, it's going to be this. Oh my God, it's going to be that. And then it turned out that it was actually a guy who hated Modern Warfare 3 so much that he was setting a timing clock for a link to be set up to take people to battlefield3.com.
That
was cruel.
I don't know.
That was a special kind of cruelty.
I think it's also perhaps genius at the same time.
Mm.
It has an edge of genius to it in my thinking.
And then there was another one, which was a ticking clock, and everyone assumed it was going to be something like really official on a website called findmakarov.com.
Okay.
And that turned out to be a big release for a fan film, which was awesome. A Modern Warfare 3 themed fan film.
Brilliant.
Which is pretty sweet. So, you know, people have done great stuff with these hoax sites before. When it turned out that this was a hoax, though, I was genuinely heartbroken. I would love to see Next Gen Fallout, and soon.
Yes. But I suppose, I mean, who Bethesda siphoned off to work on, like, Elder Scrolls Online? Because obviously that's one of their big projects at the moment. That and making sure whoever they've got developing the next, was it Wolfenstein?
They should give up on Wolfenstein. They need to stop with Wolfenstein. It's so bad.
They've put the release for that, though, haven't they?
Yeah.
Because I think it was meant to be next year, wasn't it? Was it meant to be next year?
I think it's supposed to be early on next year, yeah.
And they put it back. I've only ever watched bits and dabs of the Wolfenstein games online. I've never actually played any of them myself.
Not even Wolfenstein 3D?
Nope.
Oh, you're missing out. That's classic gaming there.
Closest I've got to that is Doom and Quake. Closest I've gotten.
Much the same. Put some Nazis in there. You pretty much get the deal.
Yeah.
It's nothing particularly special, but it's one of those things that I remember from my childhood. It's one of the very first PC games I ever got to play.
I think people need to stop trusting ticking clocks on websites.
I think if there's one thing we've learned.
there's no point in trying to believe in the power of the ticking clock.
I've just got this image of a bomb disposal expert being like, that's all right, it's probably just a hoax.
Everybody leave.
Oh.
Little did he know he saved all their lives.
I'm just trying to think, if they were going to, because obviously we talk about Fallout 4, and okay, so we had Fallout 3 that was set in the, was it DC and Boston areas?
That was the capital wasteland, yeah.
And obviously New Vegas was set around, you know, between sort of Nevada and a bit of California, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. You do visit the new California Republic for a time.
Yeah. So where would we want to see Fallout 4 set?
Well, California is a big deal in the broader canon of Fallout. Both Fallout and Fallout New Vegas both occupy what would other, so not Fallout, yeah, Fallout 2 and Fallout New Vegas all have some involvement with the new California Republic and everything else. Now, Fallout 3 was the first one to deviate from that, and you've since then had like Fallout Tactics and things like that, which have gone down slightly different directions. I would like to see a return to the Capital Wasteland.
Okay.
But I would also, part of me would kind of like, now this is asking far too much, of course, but I would love to have the whole of America.
I wonder what kind of transport system they'd have to come up with in-game that would make sense to be whizzing around the place. And I say whizzing, actually, it could be that it
could be trains.
Could be trains,
I suppose. Someone might have, you know, because bear in mind, within the context of the story, you do see people starting to reclaim the technology of the past generations before the bombs fell. And, you know, you see between Fallout and Fallout 2, that's like 100 years between the two games. And the difference around what happens. I can't remember if it's Vault 1 or Vault 13. It's been a long time since I played those games. But it starts off as this small community. But when you go to Fallout 2, it's this huge, massive, sprawling city. there's nothing to say that you could not have the same thing apply in a game which covers the whole of the United States. Because bear in mind, you had other places in Fallout 3.
Yeah.
You had the Pit. You had Pittsburgh. And you went down south as well. You went to the swamps of the Deep South. I've forgotten which expansion that was in.
I know the one you mean, but the name eludes me at this point.
Yeah. So, you know, so you've seen a lot of East Coast America through that, you know. There's nothing to say that they couldn't link the two up and have a huge game which focuses on the reunification of America and the continuing battle between the new California Republic. You wouldn't necessarily, depending on how things went with New Vegas, I suppose you could potentially have Kaiser's Legion and everything else. Mm-hmm. You'd have who are the bad guys?
Oh God,
I've completely forgotten what they're called.
What, in New Vegas?
No, in Fallout 3.
The
Conclave, or whatever.
Yeah,
they
the Conclave. Enclave. Yes.
Conclave is what popes do.
Yeah.
Or popes to be. Yeah, so you've got the Enclave. Enclave and NCR battling it out is an age-old thing. Having that across the entirety of the United States, and you could also then use this as a means of introducing the Chinese again, because you had Operation Anchorage as well in Fallout 3. So you got to see Alaska too.
I would like to know what would be happening in sort of like the Midwest and stuff though with all of this.
Where there hasn't been that much fallout, if there are any areas where there haven't been that much fallout, I'd be very interested to see. But I think this would really open it up, and that would really give you a huge wealth of understanding as to what's happened to America outside of these various somewhat restricted areas. I would love to see just the whole country and how this, and then you can go across each of the borders. You can have Mexico, you can have Canada.
Oh God! Well, yeah, that's a good point. I wonder what would have happened with Canada, because we don't. Do we know like how Canada sided?
Canada was actually invaded by the Chinese. The Chinese attacked Anchorage.
Hmm.
They invaded through Canada to get to America, and then America had their big counterattack, culminating in Operation Anchorage. And so at that point, the Chinese then fired off the missiles.
Canada.
Poor Canada.
Poor Canada.
I have no idea what's happened to Europe and so on in amongst all this. You can bet that everyone's kind of screwed.
I know the Fallout games have been kind of like a tale of the disposal of, or the destruction of a kind of weird Americana. But it would be kind of interesting to know a bit more about what happened about the wider world. I mean, what about Australia, man? Australia. You remember that animation that went around a few years ago that was about what happens when all the nukes start flying?
What's going on, mate?
Yeah. I can just imagine that happening. But only, obviously, with retro-looking tech. So.
Oh, God. That'd be quite funny.
Yeah.
If Australia is the one surviving place in the world with none of these problems.
Mind you, they're perhaps, are they, I would suppose, are they a bit closer to China than America is? I don't know.
Relatively, yeah.
Yeah, so it depends if China kind of looked at them after all this and went, they just kind of sailed down or flew down. And then
that's assuming that China didn't get destroyed as well.
That's true. I'm going to move us on now, though, to our final news story of the week, which is perhaps the coolest thing I think to happen in a while in any context. I think this thing wins hands down. The first I heard of it was when I actually saw one of the social media messages asking for some volunteers for a thing happening down in San Francisco last week, and it was basically to help a kid for a day with the Make-A-Wish Foundation to pretend to be Batman for a day, or Bat-Kid. So yes, Bat-Kid, who, rather than having, like, say, maybe a couple of hundred volunteers, which I think is what they were expecting, they ended up with something like 15,000 strangers turning up on the streets of San Francisco to witness Batkid, Miles Scott, I believe, who's sort of in recovery from leukemia.
Now in remission now.
Remission, sorry. Yeah, from leukemia. Spend a day as Batkid with a Batman. I saw pictures of a Batman with the Batkid. Saving the people of Gotham, aka San Francisco, and solving crimes. It was amazing.
And his little brother was Robin as well. Yeah. It was the cutest thing.
Did anyone else see photos? More photos? Did you see any photos, Paul?
No, I just saw the photo of Batkid.
Batkid.
It was so touching.
Yeah. It was just amazing the amount of people they managed to draw in to volunteer. I suppose it's quite a unique volunteering opportunity. Stand on these street corners and cheer the Batkid. You know. Can't imagine many volunteering opportunities that are kind of as cool as that. What was it? So he spent the day obviously as Batkid, and he was, you know, solving crimes within the environs of San Francisco, which included battling the Penguin and taking out the Riddler. Because I think those were actually probably sensible baddie choices on their part. I think if they'd chosen maybe some of the other, due to what's happened with them in contemporary comics, films and video games, choosing any other Batman bad guys at the moment would be kind of making it maybe a little too adult.
I want to see Batkid fight Bane.
Can you just imagine if they got carried away? Oops. Not only does this kid have leukemia, now he has a broken back as well.
I see you've come to foil my plan. Batman I can deal with, but not Batkid, no!
Rumours circulating, there's maybe a chance that DC might do a special comic to celebrate the event. And if they do, I have to say I probably would buy it just for the awesome factor. But some of the crimes that Batkid was trying to foil, I think the Penguin or the Riddler put a bomb somewhere in the centre of the city. He had to defuse that.
It was the Riddler.
It was the Riddler. And save a lady as well. I think there was a damsel in distress. I think I saw in the photos. And the Riddler tried to rob a bank too. And the Penguin went and kidnapped the Giants mascot Lucille, because if there's one crime, I mean, I suppose Penguin seals that. I mean, on the symbolic level, that's a pretty big crime for the Penguin to pull off.
Mm.
Yeah, because that's not a love relationship there at all, by any stretch of the imagination. So, but. I suppose I was talking about this in the office though today, and they were like, "Well, do other Make-A-Wish Foundation people like get crazy things like this?" I'm like, "Maybe? I don't know. We've never heard of it. Perhaps this will set some interesting precedent." And then, unfortunately, though, we did start discussing comic book characters that you probably shouldn't do this for,
like Bane.
Like Bane.
Constantine.
Constantine, well, Pro was one, and that's a comic book series about a prostitute, if I remember correctly. So you wouldn't do that. I did bring up The Darkness, and not the band, but the comics, obviously. And
they definitely shouldn't do anything with the band.
Yeah, definitely.
Could you imagine a kid with, like, righty and lefty?
Yeah, I know. And oh, I was God, like, no. It would just be the violence that was beyond PG-13. But because it's Jackie Estacado, he can't have sex. So none of the naughty stuff that might happen with other comic book characters wouldn't be able to happen. So he'd be, like, pretending to eviscerate mobsters. It'd be fine. Absolutely fine.
I'd want to be the Punisher.
Mm. Yes.
8-year-old goes around trying to be the Punisher. No one would know what was going on. No one would understand. All we'd know is that justice in some way, shape or form is being done.
The whole series of revenge attacks grips the city in question. Brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. I think they probably would, if they were going to pull off something like this again somewhere else, they'd probably be a child-friendly character. I bet somebody wants Spider-Man, though. Probably.
Some poor child is going to plummet to their horrific death when they try and pretend to be Spider-Man in New York.
Batman's not much better. Grappling
Batman
gun.
Batman doesn't fly.
Well, he swoops
sometimes. But this Bat-Kid was just walking around. You know, Spider Kid is going to want to be like flying around on wires and stuff like that. And you just know they're going to come a cropper. There's going to be some sort of mischief. Something's going to go wrong, and next thing you know,
Wish
Foundation gets sued.
Could you imagine Kid Judge Dredd?
I am the law! I am the law! Ow. I think you abused everyone's eardrums then. Ow.
Sorry.
I was just thinking, you say that kid was just walking around. He had a Lamborghini for the day, with stickers on it. Lamborghini, man. Lamborghini. Yeah, that's how cool his day was as Bat-Kid. That apparently, I think something like over 6,000 photographs were taken. Sort of, you know, detailing these exploits. There was a lot of social media. There was a special edition of the one of the main San Francisco papers, San Francisco Times or Chronicle or something, and it was turned into like the Gotham City Chronicle for the day, and just kind of detailed Bat-Kid's like exploits. Obviously tackled crime. What was kind of weird though was seeing some social media messages about this in general and like comments and kind of going, we see finally we've got someone to clean up crime for real and stuff, and there's a slight insinuation the Bat-Kid was perhaps a better substitute for the situation of crime in San Francisco than actual law enforcement, which obviously is a whole level of local politics in that area I have no awareness of but was slightly concerned by. Okay guys, okay, we'll turn this into something political now. Please don't. It's the kid. He's trying to, you know, he's in remission from leukemia. Did we have to turn this up? No, we're going to turn it into something political. Fine. But, yeah, Bat-Kid saved the day. And I think it's probably one of the most awesome charitable things I've ever seen done. And I'm now going to move us on to our feature for the week. Because this was a suggestion from Mr. Cooper.
Look at me being all fancy.
Yeah. He started talking to me the other day online about difficulties with literary adaptations, and we're not quite sure where you wanted to go with this, so perhaps you should continue introducing this segment, Mr. Cooper.
Well, it's an interesting one. The problem with literary adaptations, is there a problem? Is there a real difficulty? I've just noticed that very recently we've had quite a few literary adaptations coming through the Hollywood system and people just generally not being particularly happy with the results. Case in point, we're about to have the second Hunger Games film come out. So we've got Catching Fire coming out very soon. Now, I'm going to be brutally honest. I thought the first Hunger Games was bloody awful.
Okay.
I thought it was really bad. Now,
why is that?
Why did I think it was really bad? As a film, I thought the story itself was an interesting idea. Certain elements of the story were poorly executed, in particular how the people in the background were trying to get money together for buying these ridiculously expensive but very small things like the ointments and all this stuff to help out the people within the game. The political ramifications and the political efforts that were taking place in behind the scenes, which of course would, and I'm sure in the book that's a huge deal. All that's going on there and the efforts that are being made to try and get Katniss through the and Peter through the experience they're going through. I just felt it was a poorly executed story. Like in general, you know, this isn't just, you know, me having a go at the film just because it's based on a teen book or whatever. I just thought it was poorly executed. I just did not get the same kind of emotional reaction that I think a lot of cinema goers did. And I didn't particularly appreciate the film in general. I thought it was trite.
I think part of the problem is that with these things, it tends to move along with the spectacle of the books, and as you sort of seem to be suggesting, not perhaps look at the secondary, the tertiary plots and manications that are kind of happening in the background. I haven't read the Hunger Games books, but I've read all the Harry Potter books and quite thoroughly. And for me, like, say, the last few films, so the two-parter for the final book and Half-Blood Prince, and to some extent Order of the Phoenix, that the fact that there was a lot of absolute racism going on in the books, and that just didn't perhaps particularly carry on over into the films to the extent that it was present in the books. And that kind of frustrated me, because it was quite a big issue in the novels, and it was causing ramifications far and wide for the communities involved, but yet you only got a hint of it, and then that was more in the Deathly Hallows Part 1, I think. So it was just kind of like, oh great. And then of course it's just the fact that they turned the final book into two films.
One of the most upsetting elements for me when it comes to Harry Potter is the treatment of Cho Chang. You know, to have, you know, this is supposed to be Harry Potter's girlfriend, his very first girlfriend, the first person he's ever done any of the stuff he's done, you know, with like that. In the film, she gets given, was it the Cruciatus Curse or whatever it is?
Yeah,
this is something that can kill you. This is like the most horrific curse. You know, they big this up in the film. It's like, this is something that is so bad that people will go mad as a result of having it applied to them. So when Cho gives up the location of where Dumbledore's army are doing their training and everything, spoilers, you know, in fairness, it's been long enough.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone has any right to complain by now. When Cho gives up their location and, you know, What's-Her-Face closes down Dumbledore's army in their training area, essentially, and Harry is so pissed at Cho because this has happened and treats it like this massive betrayal. It's like, she had this horrible curse applied to her. He's informed of the fact that she barely survived this curse halfway on from there. But at no point does Harry ever go, oh my God, I'm so sorry. That's so horrific. That's so horrible. I can't believe it. He just scowls at her for the rest of the time in the films.
Yeah. What's interesting, though, is that in the novels, it was a friend of Cho's that gave the location away. And I don't believe it was even under duress of the Cretaceous Court. So they raised the stakes without having the full emotional implications applied.
Yeah, and that's completely ignored through the rest of the films.
Yeah.
But there's no... And all that left me thinking was, my God, Harry, you're such an asshole. I can't believe... You know, having been told everything that you've been told in this film, that you can treat her like that and everything else, to then completely ignore it for the rest of the time and to never, ever forgive her is kind of bullshit. That's kind of cruel. Not really up for that.
Okay.
I mean, you know, other films recently have been catching a bit of flack. I mean, Ender's Game.
Yeah, that's been getting a lot of... I know one of our listeners perhaps was maybe a little unimpressed with it, though I didn't, unfortunately, get a chance to finish reading his review. But, yeah, I've read the novel. It was some time ago, but it was one of those... It's probably one of the most important books to me that I read as a teenager. So I kind of remember quite a bit of it. And from what I've been hearing, it's just been the lack of... the film hasn't perhaps done the environment of all the training as well as it could have done.
I don't think it communicated it very well. And part of that is because of the fact that in the book, you know, Ender's training spans 6 years.
Yeah.
In the movie, it spans 30 days.
Really?
Yeah.
That's...
Or thereabouts. It's not very long.
Why did they condense it so much?
Because basically, the problem is, if you've got a child actor...
Oh, yeah.
That's a problem. Because when they're growing up, you know, you can tell very quickly what's going on. The other problem is the fact that... it's very hard to commute because, bear in mind, there are certain elements of the book, in particular the mind game.
Mm.
That's a huge element, and that of course plays into the later novels as well, in a huge way. I don't know if you ever read the books that followed on from there. So
I've read the Speaker for the Dead and the one that comes after that, but none of the stuff to do with like Bean.
Yeah, I mean, Bean shows up, is a bit character, not particularly important, which, in fairness, in context of Ender's Game, kind of makes sense. But at the same time, Bean is in the same launch group.
Yeah.
And Bean is the same size as Ender. You don't get any of the subplots that go along with Bean. And having read the other Bean-related books as well, that's a huge deal. You had to condense it to try and make it fit within 2.5 hours.
Yeah, that was
a huge sprawling story.
Yeah, that was one of the things I think it was Matt Herz's review sort of suggesting that it should have been two films.
I don't think it would have. Bear in mind, people have been struggling with the idea of how they're going to make this film work for 20 years.
True.
I don't think it, you know, the nature of the film itself does not inherently lend itself to that kind of stuff. I mean, when I think of films involving teen characters that have a character development of a similar style and a similar abuse, and that's really what Ender goes through in the story. I always think of Empire of the Sun.
Okay.
You know, and bear in mind that had Christian Bale as the lead character in that, and you know that spans the entirety of the Second World War. You see Christian Bale going from really tiny young school kid to savvy, street smart.
Perhaps what needed to happen was that, I mean, because they've been struggling turning it into a film for over 20 years. That perhaps was their problem. Maybe it is something that could have done with being a TV series, not necessarily a 20-odd episode TV series, but something more the kind of size of Game of Thrones.
I don't think. Well, if you started including the later novels, I think that would work. You could have easily done something along the lines of a mini series.
Yeah.
You know, your Band of Brothers, for example, or things like that, where you've got your 10 episodes. And you go from start to finish. I mean, 10 episodes, each is 45 minutes long, 450 minutes. So you're looking at 6-7 hours worth of entertainment there. You know, that would have done it justice, I think.
Yeah.
And you could have also had the age progression as well. Mm. But that would have also been a very hard sell.
Yeah. But then, I mean, this is the thing, that we keep seeing stuff being, like, from sprawling universes condensed down into films, and perhaps this is part of the problem. I mean, obviously, though, if you try to bring cinematic production costs to television, it causes a whole host of other problems. I remember, was it the costs for Heroes were pretty high during the first two seasons. Like,
there again, it looked the part compared to, you know, similar show. Well, say similar shows. Basically, anything of its time. Heroes looks really, really polished. So you could tell that there's a lot of money being spent on there.
I think they were spending something like maybe $1 to $2 million an episode.
Hmm.
But then, if you're looking at like a 20-plus episode season, that's still, I mean, discounting marketing, that's still less than perhaps is actually spent on the actual film production for a lot of the Hollywood blockbusters anyway. I suppose that your budget perhaps wouldn't have been able to have snagged somebody like Harrison Ford in that particular instance, maybe.
What I will say is Harrison Ford was the perfect casting for Graf.
Really?
Absolutely brilliant. The trouble is you don't see enough of him. Mm. And I think the person they got to play Ender, Ace of Battlefield, very good as well. Ben Kingsley as Maser Rackham, I really enjoyed him. I thought he was really good. But the way the story was constructed and the way that the film played out just let the whole thing down. Mm. And...
Well, I'm currently suffering a love-hate relationship with the Hobbit films. Like, I really like the novel. And I'm not saying I want all the song stuff and everything that happens in it. In fact, the inclusion of some of it in the film made me feel a bit uncomfortable. But it's the fact that they're dragging it out to the number of films that they are through the inclusion of Tolkien mythos and events that don't actually happen during the pages of The Hobbit. And it's just kind of... I just don't like the fact that they're kind of drawing it out the way that they are.
I got so bored during The Hobbit. I got so horrifically bored.
It was taking a long bloody time for them to do what they were doing.
Yeah. And who needs... I'm going to go on a mini rant here. Who the hell needs 30 minutes of dinner party? Of which 10 minutes is spent doing the washing up.
I haven't had the opportunity to time it because I've only seen it in the cinema.
If it wasn't half an hour, of which 10 minutes was washing up, it sure as hell felt like it. It went forever. And, you know, I get there were certain elements of that which, you know, you needed to expand for action because, you know, Tolkien's not very good at action. He doesn't really do action particularly well. I get the feeling he actively tried to avoid it in some of the storytelling in the books. And it just it dragged, it was boring. I didn't really enjoy it. And in retrospect, you know, I'm genuinely questioning whether or not I go and watch the second one. Mm. Certainly at the cinema, because you know, on the one hand, I've got my Cineworld card. I'm not going to have to pay anything out of the ordinary for it. On the other hand, I'm going to have to waste 3 hours watching one of the slowest burns I've ever experienced in cinema. I mean, bear in mind, I felt kind of the same way at certain points in the original Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Hmm.
And that's far more action-orientated.
I'm now thinking about... literary adaptations. Because the difficulties we're talking about here is sort of like so far it's been pacing, changes of plot points, and now I'm thinking about the fact that Paul and I recently watched Next, which is you're laughing, but obviously I would say as far as I can tell it's a little heard of Philip K. Dick adaptation of a short story called was it The Golden Man?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and it stars Nicolas Cage and a couple of other people. And it wasn't that bad.
It wasn't that bad.
Yeah, it was like Paul and I, we just happened to like record it off, I think, something like Channel 5 randomly onto our digi-recorder and finally got around to watching it the other week. And we were pleasantly surprised, having not expected much, because it was Nicolas Cage in a little heard-of film. And so with that situation, it could go either way, really. Because you know what Cage films are like. It could be either what the frell happened here, is this the Wicker Man, or, you know, something else entirely that's actually perhaps good. And this was sort of, it wasn't bad. And I think it was a bit better than, say, mediocre. Amazingly, looking up the film afterwards, after having watched it, and just all the negative press that it got, and it was just like, well, wait, I mean, I haven't read the short story, and so I can't say how it compares to the original, but as an execution of a concept, it worked quite well.
It was an okay movie. It was nice enough. You know, I it was years before I realized it was anything more than it was. It was actually a Philip K. Dick thing. I enjoyed it enough, but I wouldn't necessarily say it was like, yeah, out and out good. Mm. I mean, when I think of, you know, really great literary adaptations, I mean, recently you've had No Country for Old Men, for example.
Yes.
There was the recent TV adaptation of Birdsong, which is acclaimed.
Apparently people also liked Brokeback Mountain. I heard that was popular.
I've heard that was a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Mm. Well, because we finally got around to watching that a few weeks, well, about a month ago, didn't we?
Yeah.
That's a good film.
Yeah. It's one of those films where I always feel like a film's good if it feels like not a single line of dialogue was wasted.
Mm.
And for me, that was a... Because other than the fact that there was actually a lot of silence, like at least from a dialogue perspective, but it always felt like the dialogue was always meaningful and that it had its place in the whole of the film. And, yeah, it was marvellous.
It was brilliantly paced. It was beautifully shot. And the story, considering, you know, we're talking about like problems with condensing story.
Hmm.
When you think the miniseries was like 4 or 5 times longer, the fact they managed to condense it down to standard movie time and still have it executed as perfectly as before, that speaks volumes. It was a brilliant film and a fantastic adaptation, which managed to get around the problems that a lot of these films are suffering.
Do you know what something that was condensed down, a similar vein to Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, in the sense it was a spy action film, the Firstborn film? I've read the Firstborn book. I don't know what was it, what's his name who wrote it originally?
That was that Tom Clancy?
No, Robert
Ludlum. Oh, Robert Ludlum.
Ludlum, yeah. It was just, there was just so much unnecessary detail in the novel, and it was just like, it wasn't, I think, perhaps particularly hard to even try and sort of like drag out some kind of narrative. I mean, the film's very different to the novel. I mean, the whole setup of Bourne is very different, completely different kind of character. But I think that as an adaptation certainly worked because there was just a lot of wastage in the novel.
I'm not keen on the Bourne films. I actually don't think they're very good, personally.
In comparison to the novel, I think they're very good.
Oh, well, I'm not in a position to judge. My dad is a huge fan of books like that, and he thought that both of them were a bit pants. But in the same vein, Tom Cruise movie from last year, Jack Reacher.
Haven't seen it yet.
Now, Jack Reacher's an interesting one because Jack Reacher is supposed to be the Nazi super Ubermensch. She's supposed to be 6'10" and blonde and blue-eyed. And they got Tom Cruise to play him.
Yeah.
Doesn't quite work. But it's actually a surprisingly good film. And, you know, we're talking about violence and everything else. Cruise gets the intensity of Jack Reacher down absolutely perfectly. I have a lot of time for Tom Cruise in spite of his Scientological leanings.
I know that because Cookie wrote a piece about the Jack Reacher film in comparison to the books, because he's read a load of the books and seen the film, and he was quite taken with the film as well. He put that up on Hex a few months ago. So I've heard good things.
It's a good film, definitely worth a watch. So I mean, it's not like the good literary adaptations aren't out there. It just seems that recently there have been some really difficult transitions. And what always surprises me is the fact that it's the ones that go well. Half the time you don't realize they're literary adaptations.
Mm.
Yeah, for example, Alex Cross. That's another one that was out recently. I haven't seen the movie and I haven't read the books, but that got a lukewarm response. And I didn't realize it was a book until like months after it had finished in the cinemas. it's interesting seeing that, you know, either you forget it's a book, or alternatively, it's just such a good film in its own right that you never really think about the comparison. You just disregard any thought of making the comparison because of the fact that it's just like, you know, in its own right, this is a fantastic piece of work.
Can we talk about World War Z for a moment?
Ah, there we go.
Yeah. I've decided now that I quite like the film because I really love the book. I just really feel like they didn't need the name. There was no point in them buying. They could have just gone and done their own thing entirely. They didn't need the name.
They didn't need it, but at the same time, I think they wouldn't have gotten the funding if they hadn't had the name.
I suppose.
Despite the fact that it's Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt in a rocket box.
I still wonder what the thing you did, Babylon 5, you did a script for it in the early on.
J. Michael Straczynski.
JMS. Yeah, that dude that created Babylon 5 and stuff. I do wonder what his version of the film would have been like, because
he stuck
quite closely to the book, I think.
Are you aware of the big difference between what was originally being filmed and what actually happened in terms of...
Yes, because they filmed a bunch of stuff down here that wasn't used.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge chunk of the film that was completely rewritten and reshot. Are you actually familiar with the story that they were going to tell? That's
Wasn't there a whole thing about having like a battle in like the Red Square or something?
Well, if you've read the book World War Z, you'll be familiar with how the Russians handled the zombie problem. The zombies couldn't handle the cold, and
oh yeah, God, they had all those crews going around.
Yeah, they basically conscripted the entirety of the Moscow population to form these crews to go around killing the zombies. And they made makeshift weapons, and they went around just basically massacring the dead. And what happens is, you know, in the film, you got Brad Pitt, he ends up crashing and all this stuff, and he ends up in Israel. What was going to happen was, instead of them going to Cardiff, they were actually going to Russia. If you remember earlier in the film, there's reference to North Korea and Russia, and you can't get into Russia, Russia's on lockdown, blah, blah. Originally, in the original cut of the film, he was going to end up in Russia and get stuck there for like 6 months or more.
Okay.
And Brad Pitt would end up in this crew going around killing zombies. He'd come out horrifically traumatized, and he would then go back in search of his wife.
Yeah.
Now there was something that kept being pointed out when the film came out was the fact that there was a big name actor who did nothing in the film, and that's Matthew Fox of Lost fame, and he plays just what's called para jumper. He's a PJ in the film. And he goes around basically looking after Brad Pitt for a while.
Yeah.
He does nothing in the film. In the final cut of what would have been the original film before they rewrote it some people say it's a better ending. The ending didn't quite work for me. But what they said about what's been said about the original story was the wife of Brad Pitt, because he's gone so long and is assumed dead, ends up in a camp, and the military basically set up a camp, and she basically sells herself to this guy to keep her family safe.
Yeah.
Keep her and her son safe. And so she ends up hooking up with this para jumper, Matthew Fox, and by doing that ensures the safety of her family, but at the cost of, you know, everything else.
Yeah.
So that's a completely radically different story. Yeah.
And also it's making me curious for the sort of Blu-ray DVD release, because one of the things they were touting a few weeks ago when they were actually advertising that it was out was that it was like, oh, new extended cut and all that kind of thing. So it's like, right, so what did you put back in? if really anything, unless you just sort of drew out some of the scenes that just already existed in the cinematic release, or theatrical release, rather.
I'm not sure what you'd be able to really introduce to make it radically different. I mean, it seems like the answer for movies being given whole new director's cuts, blah, blah, is let's take out 5 minutes of stuff that you wouldn't need. And then we can reintroduce it later on and have a special extended edition that makes absolutely no difference.
You say that it's Paul and mine's. Do you want to talk about X3?
Well, basically, the deleted scenes from that. I think that part of the reason why they cut out some of the deleted scenes because they'd cut out other scenes that would have made sense with it. And in the end, I think the film made more sense if they would have actually have kept with the original bits.
Yeah,
far more sense.
There are plenty of films where you can make that example. I mean, a big one for me is Alien 3. Alien 3 is a terrible in its original cut. You watch it in the director's cut, and all of a sudden it becomes an incredibly good film. Yeah, and this is a film that was ritually panned, that everyone hates. You know, people complain about Alien Resurrection, but at the time, people complained far more about Alien 3 and how disappointing it was and how ridiculous it was. And that's because they cut such a huge amount of the film out that it literally made no sense afterwards. In particular, Paul McGann's role in the film.
Yes.
He had a huge role, and then it was cut down by half. And one minute, he's doing all this stuff, and it makes perfect sense. The next minute, he's in a straitjacket, and no one knows what's going on. Just, it makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
There are plenty of times where a studio will step in, get an editor to make cuts within the space of 2 weeks, ruin the film, but it gets in under time, and that's all they care about. But there's a difference between like having a serviceable cut for release and messing it up horribly. And then you can, when you've got the film where it has the serviceable release and it looks okay, you can then go, okay, well, where's that 7 minutes of stuff that we cut out just because it was completely pointless? Let's reintroduce that. There are so many films like that now. I was talking about Doom earlier on. I know Doom's a crap film. It's utterly awful. But if you ever end up watching the special extended super violent version or whatever, all they've done is they've jammed in about 4 or 5 minutes of scenes that were cut for a very specific reason. And that's because they served absolutely no purpose whatsoever in the narrative. They didn't add, you know, there were a couple of things that added a bit of action or added a bit of ultra violence. Or there's an entire briefing scene that you just don't need. It's completely non-essential. And they needed an extended edition to try and sell more DVDs. And so you ended up with that.
I'm just going to say...
Stuff like that, just...
Moving back to the subject of this bit, which was going to be literary adaptations, there is one literary adaptation that, despite whatever friggin' Oscars it won last year, that you will never get me going near, and that is Life of Pi. Anyone tries to make me watch Life of Pi, I may very well have to traumatise them as much as the original novel traumatised me when I was forced to read it as part of my degree. Never. It's like I previously read The Old Man and the Sea. That was shorter. That was enough. The Life of Pi was essentially The Old Man and the Sea, but longer. Unnecessarily longer. I don't care about the fact that they did a Pretty Tiger.
I'll be honest. I'm never going to read it. Yeah. Never going to read it, and I'm never going to watch it.
Yeah.
As much as I love tigers, I just don't think that there's enough appeal for me to really experience that. I know it won lots of technical Oscars and everything, and you know, good on them for having such a fantastic production company and so on. Shame on them for essentially bankrupting the visual effects company that worked on the film in the process. That was really upsetting for me at the time, that they're winning special effects visual effects Oscars, and the visual effects company that did it all has gone bankrupt. And, you know, and the only reason they went bankrupt was because they were working on that film. That's a joke.
It's crazy.
Rhythm and Hughes didn't deserve that. Yeah. But I mean, on a similar line, with regards to being horrifically scarred mentally and possibly even physically as a result of books that have come to haunt us all, there's another film that's currently suffering similar production woes, and that's 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh yeah, because well, they've put the release date for that back to, was it Valentine's Day in when?
I think it's like 2015 or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't help that way familiar with the casting.
Because they've had changes. It keeps changing, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Originally, it was going to be the star of... what TV show is it? I completely blanked. Really love it. Sons of Anarchy.
Okay.
And the movie Pacific Rim. They were going to have... the star of this TV show, and I've completely blanked his name. Charlie Hunnam. Charlie Hunnam was going to play Christian Grey. Now, Christian Grey for me is, you know, I can say that I've actually read the 50 Shades novels, mostly because if ever I'm going to complain about something, I actually want to know what it is I'm complaining about. When I think of the character of Grey, this is someone who is, he's a billionaire. He's incredibly savvy. He's incredibly intelligent, cultured. You know, this is someone truly belonging to the upper classes and the upper echelons of society. When I think of that person, I do not think of Charlie Hunnam. you know, that guy from Pacific Rim, the biker guy from Sons of Anarchy. I'm pretty certain, and this has been said, that when he was announced as, you know, the fact he was going to play Christian Grey, the guys on Sons of Anarchy ripped him so hard for it that he eventually quit on that ground alone.
Wow. I think I'm going to have to wrap this up. I'm shocked by that revelation. It's goodbye from
Peter Cooper. You can catch me on Twitter at Peter B Cooper, Facebook. I forget the Facebook. I never use that thing anyway. But yeah, catch me on Twitter, and I'll probably be dishing out some kind of abuse to someone, probably about the Miami Dolphins.
Okay, and it's good night from me, Paul Blewett. I'm on Twitter as Paul Blewett.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. You can find me on Twitter at EK6891. You can find Nerd Assemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. We're also available on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at Nerds Podcast, plus we're on Facebook and Google Plus as Nerd Assemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out hexdimension.com. We've had the last of our 22 panels, comic art show interviews go up today. So go check that out. And that's it. Good night.
Good night.
Good.